All right, our study today is in Deuteronomy 25. I thought before we read the chapter, I'd make a comment about where we are in the study and what plans are. So the plan is to cover chapter 25 this week and chapter 26 next week, and then take a break from the book of Deuteronomy. It's a natural place to take a break from Deuteronomy in terms of the structure of the book. And after that, we plan to do a study on worship, which I thought about it for a while. Maybe the best word I have in mind is worship practice, as opposed to the theology of worship, or, say, defending why we worship the way we do, to talk about the practice of worship. So, Lord willing, we'll start that in 2 weeks. But for today, we're still in Deuteronomy, and we'll read chapter 25. Does include at least one topic that's not discussed in polite company, but here we are. Deuteronomy 25. If there is a dispute between men and they come to court that the judges may judge them, and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence, according to his guilt, with a certain number of blows. 40 blows he may give him, and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated in your sight. You shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, "I do not want to take her," then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house." And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him who had his sandal removed. Two men fight together, and the wife of one draws nearer to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him, and puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals. Then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall not pity her. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Therefore it shall be, when the Lord your God has given you rest from your enemies all around, in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Now this chapter has six distinguishable sections, one of which is only one verse long. And my plan is to actually cover them all. In the past couple of weeks, I've tried to summarize some, but I think each of them has a significance, and there is a certain coherence of thought among some of them. And so we'll do our best to get through all of these. So the first section covers the first three verses, which has to do with what you could call justice and dignity, even for the wicked or for the criminal. Now, the statement in the first three verses is similar to the statement in the opening of chapter 24. There's an if, it goes on and on, and then what will happen. So there's an assumption here in verse one, that the judges will judge rightly. They will justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. I want to come back to that in terms of what God does in just a minute. But that, of course, commandment that they should judge in that way is found elsewhere in Scripture. So unlike the first verse of Deuteronomy 24 having to do with divorce, it really does seem to deal clearly with something that's commanded elsewhere. So the context then is that a man has been condemned because of a crime, and he is to be punished. And the punishment is that he will be beaten or flogged or scourged. He will be beaten with a whip, whatever the translation you have is. And the provision is a striking one in terms of the way it distinguishes the practice among the Hebrews to, say, the later practice in Western Europe, for example, which is that it preserves the dignity and, you might say, also the health of the criminal. So it says specifically that he will not be beaten by more than 40 blows. 40 is the limit. It's not saying that you have to give 40 lashes. It's a limit on the number of times the person could be beaten. And that says specifically that your brother not be humiliated in your sight. So the general principle here is that there should be respect even for the criminal, even for the dignity of the criminal. Though he was condemned and though he deserved to be scourged, there is a provision here to, as I said, preserve his life and his health, but especially his dignity. Now, it's further controlled by the way the carrying out of the punishment is described. Well, first of all, he is rightly condemned. That's the point of verse 1. But notice that it occurs in the presence of the judge. So we hope that the judge is not the bloodthirsty executioner, but someone who can restrain someone who would be bloodthirsty. Executioner, and not in the sense of killing, but carrying out the penalty. So the judge is there. It says in verse 2 also that it is according to his guilt, which suggests that the number of lashes should be proportional to the crime or the significance of the crime. And then, as I've already noted, there's a limitation on this. So it's a carefully measured out judgment. Now, this beating with 40 lashes probably sounds familiar. The Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians refers to the fact that he was 5 times beaten. The Jews had a practice of giving 39 lashes, probably to avoid exceeding what the law said. There's some discussion on that point. But this was the practice, as I said, among the Jews in Jesus' time. Jesus himself was scourged before he was crucified, and Paul and the apostles also were scourged. I mentioned the Western practice. It turns out that in later, like this is post-Reformation, Western Europe, the limit was increased so that some people received as many as 1,000 lashes. Whether anyone could survive such a beating is a significant question, but the law is here for a reason, and it applies more generally, as I said, to the way people should mete out justice, not to be bloodthirsty, but to remember that the man is made in the image of God. A lot of these sections have very interesting additional lights on them, and I want to mention one of the other just briefly, and that is in the disputes about the doctrine of justification. Okay, so whoa, what does that have to do with 40 lashes? Well, this verse actually comes up, and the reason is that one of the disputes historically between the reformers and Rome was about the meaning of the word justification. Because Rome tended to include in their use of justification what we would call sanctification. So in Rome, justification included the transformation of the individual. And the reformers and later reformed folks argued from the scriptures that the word to justify almost always means to declare righteous in a forensic sense. And so this verse is important because you can see the contrast here. You either justify the righteous or you condemn the wicked. Now, when you condemn a wicked person, you don't transform his nature to make him wicked. You declare him legally to be wicked. And so obviously then the contrast is that the judges, in justifying the righteous, aren't making the person righteous or making him a better person. They're recognizing his legal status, that he is held as having fulfilled the law, as not having broken the law. So that argument applies both in the original Hebrew and in the Greek word, because the same Greek word for justify, or that family of words, is used in the New Testament about our justification. So that I put up on the board some references along those lines, because God says, I will not justify the wicked. Okay? And that's using the word justify in this forensic sense. Okay? Now that raises another question. If God says he will not justify the wicked, the judges are supposed to act like God in this way. They are supposed to condemn the wicked. And if in fact, as the scriptures teach, none of us is righteous, all of us are wicked, how can God do that? Well, that's a story for another day, but it is true that even the Old Testament points us to the way that God can justify the wicked, namely by imputing the righteousness of another to them. So Abraham was justified because he believed in God, and the book of Jeremiah, for example, looks forward to the Lord our righteousness. So this is just one indication of how the sort of obscure statement in the book of Deuteronomy is helpful for understanding our own acceptance before God. Let's do at least one other verse before I pause and see if you have comments. Verse 4 is, I think, conceptually connected with the first three verses. Klein, the commentator, makes that point. Verse 4 is a fairly simple statement, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Okay, so what is going on here? Well, this was their agricultural practice. If they wanted to thresh grain, they would take oxen and either have them trample the grain or pull a sledge behind them, which would separate out the parts that they wanted. And the commandment is that while the ox is doing this, the ox should be allowed to eat some of what he produces in this. Okay. Now, it is, you might say, a little surprising that there should be a specific verse in the Bible about allowing an ox to eat while he works. And there is a clear implication from this, which we've seen recently in Deuteronomy, like at the end of the last chapter, the provision for gleaning. There seems to be a clear connection from oxen to men. We would call it an argument from the lesser to the greater. If the worker who's an ox is allowed to eat the fruits of his labor, surely the worker who is a man should be allowed to do so. Gleaning is one example of that. There are other references you could point to in Deuteronomy. So this is a provision, again, in this case, really of rewarding the righteous, rewarding the labor. So if you want to look at the first three verses as a just condemnation of the wicked, but respecting the dignity, so verse 4 has to do with rewarding the laborer and recognizing, you might say, his dignity, honoring him for the work he's done. Now that verse by itself would be interesting. It's even more interesting because the Apostle Paul uses it twice in the New Testament to say that those who minister the word should be compensated properly. So one reference that we won't look at in 1 Timothy 5 is interesting because it refers to the scriptures and quotes this and also the book of Luke. Interesting that Paul would refer to the Gospel of Luke as the scriptures. But let's turn to 1 Corinthians 9 and keep your finger or whatever in Deuteronomy 25. I want to make a point from this. I told you that there are reasons why I decided to go through each of these sections, and there is a significant point connected with this for the way we understand the Old Testament as New Testament believers. The Apostle Paul, in the first several verses of chapter 9, is really defending his ministry and saying that he has a right to be compensated for his work. He actually didn't take that up, but he had a right to do so. And to defend that right, he says in verse 8, after some you might say, natural law sort of arguments. You know, everyone who, like the one who goes to war is paid, at least his expenses are covered when he goes to war, and so on. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9:8, "Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, 'You shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain.' Is it oxen God is concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope." It's a fairly straightforward argument there, that Paul is saying God is not just writing Deuteronomy 25:1 for oxen. Okay, I think we would have figured that out already. We did figure that out already. But the way he applies it is interesting, and the words that he used to apply it, he says, "This was written for our sakes." Now, Paul, elsewhere in Corinthians and elsewhere in the New Testament, says that really the Old Testament was not written so much for the believers in the Old Testament as it was written for us. He says that in the next chapter, in chapter 10, these things were written as instructions for us and as warnings for us. And this is a particularly striking fact because the Apostle Paul is using the law. Right, but believers aren't under the law. We're under grace. We don't need to read the Old Testament. It's not relevant to us. We just walk in love. Well, apparently not. The Apostle Paul takes what's usually called a case law. That is, it's illustrating a general principle by a specific case. It's an application of the Ten Commandments. And Paul says, this applies to us. In fact, he says, it was written for us. More than it was written, you might say, for the believers of the Old Testament. This is not my justification for a lengthy study in Deuteronomy in which we discuss embarrassing things, but this is an example of how we should read the Old Testament, realizing that it was written specifically for us, those who are privileged to live after the coming of Christ and have a fuller revelation. Okay. The reference in 1 Timothy is interesting too, but it also has to do especially with the ministry of the word and rewarding those who minister the word. Let me pause there and see if you have any comments or questions on, look, we've covered four verses in 20 minutes in Deuteronomy 25. Any comments? Jeff?
What do you think the specific meaning of humiliating someone if they have more than 40 blows? I think in modern culture, we would think it would be humiliating if you had to go before the magistrate and receive five blows.
Right.
Was this kid in Singapore some, you know...
He was caned or whatever.
Yeah.
If you're asking, like, the specific number 40, I don't know that there's a particular justification for it, but...
I mean, I'm just thinking from our viewpoint, we would think it'd be humiliated how many ever sure. blows you received.
Right.
The only thing that comes to mind for me is that somebody might be able to withstand 40 blows and still stand upright or whatever.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're right. Any discipline is humiliating. At least it should be. It's intended to humble the person and to correct the person. I think it is the kind of thing that would leave a permanent record, as it were. So this is a person who for the rest of his life will be known as the one who was beaten for stealing something or whatever he did wrong. So it has to do with attacking his dignity as a person made in the image of God. You might say any blows would do that, but I think you could make the case that there's a distinction there. It's a good question. It is intended, in a sense, to humble or shame the person, but there's a limitation involved. And it's the kind of thing I think we've seen elsewhere where God commands people, judges to act justly, parents to act righteously, but also places limits on it. So, you know, the bloodthirsty executioner can't just, as we would say, beat the tar out of the guy just because he likes that kind of thing. I always think of Mutiny on the Bounty, where the second chapter they're flogging this guy, but he's dead, you know, after a sailor for some offense. Good question. Any other questions? Yes.
I don't know if this is pertinent or not, but when I read that, I usually thought of Ammon and what he did to his sister and how he despised her after he did whatever his passion wanted to. Mm. And if you just abandon yourself to punishing somebody without guidelines, you have a tendency to just not want to see them again, to hate them.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So you really just look on the person as a someone whom you've brutally treated and you can't really relate to anymore. That's very good. Yeah. And this would obviously have applications to parents relating to their children. You know, fathers, not exasperate your children, that sort of thing. Seeing Samuel Holder Roth sort of somehow fitting here. He's smiling.
Just to sell your children on eBay, does it limit the price you can get for
them? Yeah, I think there is a limit on the price, pretty sure.
$40 or
something. Okay. Let's move on then to the next section, which is the longest section in the chapter. It's all of 6 verses long. This has to do with what's usually called levirate at marriage. From the Latin levir, which has to do with the brother-in-law. So the situation is that you have two brothers who live together. So they share some real estate. One of them is married and dies without issue. And the law lays an obligation on the surviving brother to marry his sister-in-law and to have a child by her. And the child that he has by her will take the name of the deceased man. Okay, so I'll come back to that. It doesn't particularly sound significant to us, but that's the way it's described in verse 6, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And verse 9, that he refuses to build up his brother's house. So I'll try to explain the significance of that in a minute, but it's a duty which is serious enough that the person, well, I'll get to that in a second also, the person who refuses to do it is to be shamed. So that's the basic requirement, that the person is supposed to raise up a son, presumably an heir to his brother, and his deceased brother, so that his name would not be blotted out of Israel. Now, there is a provision that if the man doesn't want to do this, then he can refuse. It's rather striking that Calvin goes on and on at this point about saying how when men and women marry each other, they should love each other. And of course, you think of Calvin as, you know, sending valentines to his wife and all that kind of thing, just a lovey-dovey kind of guy. But seriously, he actually goes on and says how important it is. And in his time, you know, there wasn't the same sort of freedom we have in ours. Whether that's a direct application of the passage or not is another question, but here it says, if the man doesn't want to take his brother's wife, then he can refuse to do so. But in refusing to do so, he is shamed by the woman he should have married. And there is an appropriate connection here. That is, the one who refused to honor his brother's name and preserve his brother's name will permanently have on record his name as shamed. Verse 10, his name shall be called the house of him who had his sandal removed. I mean, that doesn't shame me particularly. I'd like to go around without sandals. But this was a shame which was put on the man as the name of his line, because he refused to honor his brother's line. It's the sort of lex talionis, the sort of poetic justice, I guess we would say, that you find often in the law of God. Now, this practice is an ancient practice. This is the only regulation of it, the only commandment that it should be practiced in the scriptures. But it goes back at least to Genesis 38. Remember Tamar and the attempt to provide a replacement for her husband who had died, which didn't go very well in many ways, Genesis 38. There is not a command but a practice, and this practice is found in other cultures of the ancient Near East. This is also related to what's going on in the book of Ruth. We studied Ruth fairly recently. It's a little bit more complicated in Ruth because, you know, you have Naomi and Ruth, and you have rather difficult circumstances to sort out. But there's at least something like that going on. It's related to the law that we find elsewhere that the kinsman redeemer should help his distressed brother or other relative. So if the relative had to go into poverty, the kinsman redeemer should get him out of poverty, should buy him out of slavery. So it's related to other ideas in the law where there was a close sense of the family unit and the desire to care for each other. Now let me make one other comment before we talk about the meaning of it. There are some questions that come up in connection with this which different commentators resolve in different ways. For example, what if the surviving brother was already married? Okay, then he's required to practice polygamy. Another one which you might not think of immediately has to do with incest. So the law specifically rules out a situation like this. If under the law in general you are not supposed to marry someone related to you by blood or by what's usually called affinity, so by marriage. I put up the references there in Leviticus 18:16 and 20:21. Some of the older commentators say that in situations like this, it wasn't the immediate brother, but the brother should be understood more generally as a relative. That was certainly the case with Mr. Nobody and Ruth, the one who didn't get a name in Ruth because he refused to name to take Naomi or Ruth, depending on how you want to look at the description. So there are different ways this is addressed. I think the modern commentators tend to say that those laws are relaxed in this case, that the man, even though he was closely related and even though it would normally be incest, that he is commanded here to take his brother's wife. Now, what is the significance of this? Well, I think all of us can relate to a certain extent to the desire of not wanting the family name to die out. Okay, and I think we all probably have relatives who didn't marry, and maybe it's a sad sort of thing where you don't see anyone descending from them to represent them, especially when they die. But in Israel, it went deeper than that because the land was so closely connected with the promises that God had given to them. And the land was passed down, obviously, through inheritance. It was a fixed piece of real estate, which was divided up. For the widow to go outside of the family, she would not take the property with her, but there would be a question then about the succession of the property. Let me just add that this is partly a provision of mercy for the widow, who had abandoned, you might say, her own family and entered into this family, and they're seeking to care for her as a member, newly received in her own family. There are various ways in which it's a provision for her. But the focus is especially on the provision of the husband and probably has to do with the question of the inheritance and the land which was connected so closely with it that his name would not die out. But commentators point out that this was intended not merely to, say, flatter the pride of man who would like to have his name live on. Psalm 49, for example, talks about how the wealthy think that their immortality will be in the lands that they pass on and the property they pass on. Rather, that law in the Old Testament about the land was ultimately intended to direct them forward to Christ, who would gain all and restore all to God in the new heavens and the new earth. And so, ultimately, the hope for the provision of the enduring name was the hope that one would participate in the coming Messiah so that his name would be preserved in the genealogy. So let me explain that point in particular. When the brother takes the wife and this child is born, the child is legally the son of the man who died. Okay, so in the genealogy, if it was, say, Joe who died and Joe gave birth to Billy Bob, okay, well, but even though Billy Bob's actual biological father was Fred, the genealogy would say, you know, Billy Bob, son of Joe. That is, it would list the legal father, not the biological father. And that was to preserve the name of the man who died. He would have a genealogy among the people of Israel. He would legally live on in his son. And that's that significance of that is lost on us. It's lost on us many times when we read all these genealogies in the Old Testament. But they're there because God worked in history to bring about the coming of the Messiah. And the one who hoped in God and hoped in the Messiah was encouraged by this law that his share would not be lost in this, in his premature death, but his share in the Messiah and in the world to come in which the Messiah would restore all things, his share would be preserved by this provision. Now, like many of the laws in the Old Testament, it's teaching the ABCs to children. Okay, it was helping them with things that they could understand, but it still pointed forward to a profound truth, and the profound truth is true for us as well, right? We are adopted. Christ's name is put on us, even though we naturally would have no share or any hope at all. It's a beautiful thing to reflect on, and I think it's worth the further meditation, the way this law encouraged them to hope in the Messiah to come and encouraged them to hope in the inheritance that they would have ultimately through that Messiah. Let me pause there also and see if you have any comments or questions on that section. Yes, Dan.
So was Boaz the kinsman redeemer?
Yeah, only like I said, it's...
Him as the, I think it does, in the genealogy of Christ.
Yes.
Boaz, not the brother whose name escapes me.
Well, see, that's why it's really complicated in Ruth. It's not a straightforward application of the kinsman-redeemer law. I talked about it a little bit when we studied Ruth, but even then I probably tried to avoid the details. It's not exactly clear even what's going on, because there's this property, and first Boaz says to the Mr. Nobody, you know, you can have this property. And then he throws in the wife when he sort of bites on the hook of the property. So it's all a little bit complicated in Ruth. It's clear that there's something like this going on, and even the procedure there had to do with the sandal, I think. I'm trying to remember the wording in Ruth. I don't think there was any spitting going on, but it's complicated in Ruth. It's not a simple application. So Boaz was named, and I suppose you could say that it was a way of honoring the person who went to that extreme to care for this helpless Ruth and her mother Naomi, her mother-in-law Naomi. I'll wiggle out of that one. Other comments? This is one of these laws. I remember when we were studying Leviticus several years ago, I never really thought about the Jubilee and its connections to Christ and the richness of the way God provided that. The law of the Levirate is a similar sort of law. I hadn't really thought about it until this last week, but it's worth meditating on and thinking about how God was teaching them by things they could understand and relate to look forward to something greater. John.
The commentary that you did read, because the immediate question that came to my mind was the Ruth is already married.
Yeah.
So, did they interpret it differently, or?
Calvin, for example, said that this could go to someone who wasn't married, didn't have to be a brother in the literal sense. That would avoid the incest as well as the polygamy. Some modern commentators don't bat an eye at it and say, well, they practice polygamy. And it is kind of funny because we think of that, but actually incest was treated as a more serious thing. We don't tend to think of it in that way, but incest was serious. It was called an abomination by God. And yet in this case, apparently was commanded, unless you say it was some sort of exception. I mean, unless you say it doesn't have to be the immediate brother. But I think generally the older commentators want to find some way out of saying it had to be the literal brother, or that it didn't have to be a married person. It could go to someone else. And others say otherwise. It is very carefully restricted, I'll point out. The brothers are dwelling together. Okay, so if you're following this literally, then you can't go shopping for the closest relative. It's the guy who's there, and otherwise apparently there aren't any other substitutes, which is again a difference with Ruth, because apparently in other cases there were other provisions. So John looks more confused now than he asked when he asked the question. The way I understand it, it probably is allows for polygamy and an exception to the law of incest in this narrow situation. That's the way I understand it.
I think my confusion was just with the incest thing. So it's still incest if the brother dies?
Yep. Okay. That's the way most people understand the laws in Leviticus.
Right.
Yeah. That... Yeah.
So,
you can read our testimony, which comments on this part of the confession. That you wouldn't believe it. Maybe you would. There's actually a lot of discussion on exactly what constituted incest in that situation. And so our testimony makes a comment about this point. But most of the commentators historically have understood this to be an exception to the law.
I should say if it's not the literal brother, but possibly some cousin, that it's hard to understand where the shame would be in turning it down if it's your second cousin three times
right.
removed.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, it's hard for us to understand. I think maybe if they had a closer sense of community, then it would be different. But I think I met him at a family reunion once, but I don't really remember who he is, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. Yes. We're interested in this section, Stan.
Well, maybe a minor point, but if you don't think if you take a view that this would happen outside of any notion of polygamy, then I guess for the guy who does marry her, that's it. That's right. That'd be his only wife.
Right.
He would essentially have, and I guess maybe subsequent children would be his. Or something.
Right. Subsequent children would be his. Right. It's just the first heir that would be treated as his deceased brothers. Yeah, but it is a significant commitment, and yeah.
I was wondering too, is there any comparison at all between like what happened with her and Onan and Tamar? In that case, it doesn't necessarily seem like they were marrying Tamar, but just producing a seed and then getting on with it. I don't know.
Right.
But it seems in Leviticus it actually is a marriage.
It does require marriage. Yes. This was a practice known in other cultures as well, how regulated it was, and whether in that case, you know, it was just give her a seed, you don't have to marry her. It's not really known. It was pretty clear that they weren't going by the book, whatever it was they were doing. I mean, Judah was the one ultimately who was at fault, but the first attempt ended in death because the person was sinning against her. Okay. Well, all right.
Like making you uncomfortable.
What's that?
Like making you uncomfortable.
No, it's... well, just wait till we get to the next few verses. Yeah, I haven't gotten anywhere yet. Okay, so I mentioned there was something we don't talk about in polite company. Verse 11 actually probably does... Conceptually, verses 11 and 12 do conceptually belong with the preceding verses in this sense. So this is the case of two men fighting. The wife of one of them attempts to help her husband. So, I mean, it's good to be concerned about your husband, I suppose, but the way she does it is by grabbing the opponent by his private parts. I think that's the way the ESV puts it. And there is a penalty for this, which is that she will lose her hand. Let me just comment, first of all, since we tend to think of certain cultures where they chop off parts of the body frequently, this is the only case in the law where a person is specifically commanded to lose a part of the body. Now, in general, this lex talionis I've already referred to, the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, could be interpreted literally. I don't know of examples like that. So it's clearly treated as a significant situation. Why is it so serious? Well, again, commentators point out several factors. I'll mention two of them. One of them is the indecency or immodesty associated with it. But the other is something that, again, we perhaps wouldn't think of. This could prevent the opponent from having children. Okay, so this goes back to the world of thought in the preceding verse, where his line is basically cut off, potentially by this sort of injury. That, to me, is a satisfactory explanation of the seriousness of it. I mean, the immodesty is certainly a serious thing, but I think that draws the connection with the preceding verses and the, if not the particular practice, at least the world of thought in the preceding verses, the idea that the significance of a man having a name and the continuance of that name was greater than we normally realize. I'm going to go on to the next verses. If you have questions, you can ask at the end. I mean, this is one reason why people probably don't want to study Deuteronomy. Okay, verses, we're going to come back to that question of the name, Lord willing, in the last section, but there's one other section in between, and that has to do with differing weights and differing measures. Okay, so they typically used scales, you know, like the sort of scales you see with Lady Justice or whatever she's called, you know, holding, and I'll try to come back to that too. And so if the warning is, let's just talk about weights as opposed to measures, but the warning with respect to weights is that you shouldn't have two sets. Why would you want to have two sets? Well, let's say that you're the buyer for the local IGA, and the farmer comes in to sell you some of his potatoes. Okay, sorry, but no, they didn't have potatoes, you know, famine and all that. But so he comes in with potatoes, and the farmer says, I have a pound of potatoes. And the guy gets out his set of weights. That's what they used. They were stones for putting on the other side of the scales to measure it, only he got out the smaller stones to measure what he's buying. He says, that's not a pound. Look, see? So he would pay less than he should for the actual pound of potatoes. But then when the person came in to buy the same pound of potatoes, okay, they didn't measure by pounds either, but he came in to buy, he would get a different set of stones out, heavier ones. And the buyer would say, how much do these weigh? And he'd say, see, they weigh a pound by the stones that I use. So there were two sets of weights that way. And as well, they had two measures. It was a way of defrauding people. Okay? And, you know, and unless you had a National Institute of Standards, a NIST, around, it should be called something else, but, you know, you were really vulnerable to this kind of thing. And presumably the poor who had fewer resources and less credibility would be even more vulnerable in a situation like this. This is treated so seriously that God calls it an abomination in verse 16, which is a very strong word. It's not used all that often. It's often used for perverted sexual sin and just horrible idolatry. And here it's used for a commercial transaction in which one person tries to defraud another. One other indication of the seriousness of this before God is the long list of verses which talk about exactly the same thing. And this is not an exhaustive list, but Leviticus 19:36, so earlier in the law, and then Proverbs often talks about this. The minor prophets talk about this. There was discovered in the time of the minor prophets in some archaeological dig a merchant shop that had two sets of weights. Okay, so this is a way that people took advantage of others. But as often in the law, it's not merely a matter of merchandise. It seems to point beyond that to, well, to the idea of justice. And that's where, you know, the blindfold Lady Justice holding the scales is probably a helpful image here. It's interesting that in verse 15, and here ESV isn't as helpful, the New King James says, you shall have a perfect and just weight, or righteous weight. I think the ESV doesn't use that word, right? It says fair or something, which doesn't communicate quite the same thing. And a perfect and just measure. So here it's indicating something about justice and righteousness. And notice in verse 16, all who do such things, all who behave unrighteously. So it does seem to be fitting in maybe with the first part of the chapter and the discussion of meting out punishment fairly. They were supposed to condemn the wicked and they were supposed to justify the righteous. And maybe the connection you can see just by thinking about a society in which every merchant had two sets of weights. There can be no free market no fair market exchange if people are cheating like that. I remember in discussions shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union and people talking to countries like Hungary that had lived under communist rule for a long time. How can we institute a free market system? Well, part of it is just a societal expectation of honesty and fairness. It's not going to work in a society where you're used to cheating the guy, because the communist official is going to get you one way or the other. You know, you just learn to live in that situation. So I think that's one way in which we can understand that this is not merely about commercial transactions, putting your finger on the scale at Walmart or something like that. This has to do with the way a society functions and the way people are to act in justice toward one another and honesty, even in commercial affairs. Okay, one other section. Verses 17 through 19. Remember Amalek, you shall not forget. That's what brackets the section. People who do this sort of literary analysis notice that kind of bracketing. It starts with remembering and ends with a warning not to forget. This is something very important to them. And the warning about Amalek is that they are to blot them out. Now, the Amalekites were one of the peoples of Canaan. So they had already been commanded to wipe out the Canaanites. This is nothing new in a sense. But the Amalekites were especially targeted by God. If we had more time, Exodus 17, 8 through 16 is a good place to look, where God says his war against Amalek will never end. Okay, so we've talked about that, I think, elsewhere, and I think it was in Deuteronomy. It's an interesting thing to trace through the scriptures in the references, especially to Amalek. And Amalek really becomes a picture of the enemies of God, of the hostile, unrepentant enemies of God who will be blotted out. Just as the destruction of the Canaanites, which is a horrible thing for us to think about, is for us to be an image of the destruction of the wicked ultimately in hell. So particularly the opposition of the Amalekites is a picture of the judgment that God brings. So why did Saul lose his kingship? 1 Samuel 15. Because he refused to destroy the Amalekites. Who was the great enemy of the people of God in the book of Esther? Haman, who was an Amalekite. And so this is a recurring... put anyone to sleep. This is a recurring image in Scripture. What's specifically mentioned here is that they attacked the rear of the people of Israel. So this is where the stragglers, where the weak would be. The Amalekites showed no mercy and attacked them. And it says they didn't fear God. They didn't fear God and were willing to attack the people of God. What I'd like to close with is just note that what it says here specifically about the Amalekites is that their name will be blotted out. Okay, so that's the conceptual connection, especially with the law of the Levirate. Notice it says, you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. So if you step back and want to take away from the chapter, other than the rather uncomfortable things we talked about, you can think about the fact that God wants to preserve the name of his people because Christ's name is put on them. But he cuts off the name of the reprobate. And so one verse in Proverbs 10, which really summarizes it well, the memory of the righteous will be blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot. And that's what Amalek is to be an emblem for in terms of the rotting of their name, the blotting out of their name as those who hated God and who are, for us, a symbol of all who ultimately rebel against God. And we've already talked at length about the ethnic cleansing that is represented here by the Amalekites and the other Canaanites. So I won't answer any questions on that. But any comments or questions on the chapter as a whole? Yes.
Sorry, not on the chapter. I was going to go on.
Okay.
Weights and measures.
Yeah. No. Yeah, any part of the chapter. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That has a lot of, it seems like, very broad-ranging implications,
yeah,
including to our own monetary system.
Yeah. So Gary North has a long section on fractional reserve banking. Yeah. Inflation is another application.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, well, I think
I know, right.
Yeah, I think actually the fact that we don't think too much about its direct application here to scales, right, because we have NIST, we have every state has bureaus or agencies that go around
right.
gas station scales and so on. It's part of our Christian heritage, actually, that we don't have to really think about it very much.
Right. Now, that is a really good point. That's why it's important for us to think of the law always as a case that applied to them that they could understand. And our duty, as Paul does for us in 1 Corinthians 9, is to say, well, now what? How does this apply in our situation? And various ways in which the monetary system is jiggered is that a good economical term? My brother has a PhD in economics. He wouldn't appreciate me using the word jiggered should be a technical term. Anyway, the way they fiddle with jigger, whatever the monetary system is. There were several pages of Gary North's commentary. And Randy gave a talk on this once, I think.
But in this recent presidential campaign, Ron Paul raised the Proverbs verse, and there were a lot of evangelicals sitting out, and we talked about the weights and measures.
Right. Yeah.
He just gave a blank stare.
Right.
Had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, there are lots of things to think through. It's not like us. Easy, straight, long, and you can draw. You have to think carefully about it. But the point is that, and this is really the point I was trying to make earlier from 1 Corinthians, is that the apostle encourages us to do that. He encourages us not to, he encourages us to think about what the law says for us, to think carefully about it because it's relevant. And not just to say, we don't have those kind of scales anymore, so it doesn't matter. Other comments? Okay. Let's close in prayer.